Blog Talk Radio.
Looks like we're shy of one horse.
You brought two too many.
Thank you.
welcome to another edition of the Soul Tree Radio in the Raw. I'm your host, Michael Lewis Ingram. And as always, it is good to be with you. Soul Tree Radio in the Raw, proudly sponsored by BASNNewsroom.com, Black Athlete Media, and the establishments of the Black Athlete Sports Network. Get all the good shit, the who, what, when, where, why, who, what, when, where, and why, and how, right now at www.basnnewsroom.wordpress.com or www.blackathletemedia013.com. Riding shotgun with me as always, and getting his begging in, because begging is hard to do. Of course it is. My brother Gary Norris Gray, working from the love side with the music box. What's up, G?
What's up, man? How you doing? Great show tonight.
Yes, indeed. Now, we got a little something special tonight since it's near the end of Black History Month. We're going to make a little history ourselves as I wait for the rest of our brothers to come on. Our brother Fred Woodard, the professor, says that we should never stop telling our own stories.
Yes, sir.
I have an original one for you tonight that all of us will chime in on. It's with some mixed emotions, admittedly, because this person's no longer on the corporal plane with us. He has become an ancestor, and as such, should be respected. But I want everybody to know about Jason Hoover. Jason Hoover was born 1947 in Edmonton, Alberta, a hotbed of soul if ever there was one. Now, we know there were a lot of Black Canadians out there, and the ones who had gotten to Canada through the Underground Railroad, the ancestors were pretty much based in the eastern part of Canada. But this pocket of Black folks was in the middle of western Canada. So my brother Tony McLean is coming. What I want to do, though, is I want to make these 2 points. One, soul music is not in a vacuum. It's like the force. It can be reached from everywhere and anywhere, and all things are soulful. It all depends on who's doing it. Now, having said that, as Jason grew up in Edmonton, you know, there were some Black folks around, but not a lot. So you get exposed and you use what you got. He fronted an Elvis-type band. He was always comfortable in front of the camera, and he was on children's shows as a kind of mini guest slash host. When he reached puberty, past that, and into his teenage years, he decided he wanted to sing. He had two choices: go 1,000 miles away to Vancouver, or go all the way east to Toronto. And, you know, back then, Toronto was even more influential than it was to the rest of Canada. Everything flowed from Toronto. So it was a life-changing decision that Jason made coming to Vancouver. As he came to Vancouver, he started getting gigs in small places, moving up the chart to bigger places, and finally catching a break with meeting one Bobby Taylor. Bobby Taylor would become more prominent later on, but he joined his band Little Daddy and the Bachelors and became their lead singer. And as they transformed, a group of instrumentalists called themselves the Epics took him on as their lead singer, and they became Jason Hoover and the Epics. It was in December of 1968, they recorded their first hit song. Thank you. Gotta have king size. Bring that shit on up. Well, now, it was interesting. It was interesting, as my brother Tony McClain is in the house. This kind of groove is the kind of groove that any group of enterprising brothers could cook up. You know? It just sounded like a bunch of brothers jamming. But what was intriguing about this was that this wasn't New York or Philly or Chicago. This happened in Vancouver, British Columbia. And Vancouver and Chicago or New York or Philly or any other music city was as different as night and day. And good evening.
How are you, sir?
Now, what we're talking about today is the fact that Jason Hoover was truly a visionary. And if you haven't heard about him until now, it's not your fault. Canada has this really funky thing with their heroes or people who are innovators. If they endeavor to do something different, you don't know about most of them unless they're white. And let's put it this way. Jason is definitely not white. But what we do know is that there was efforts over and over and over again to deny this brother. And he got as far as he got on his own steam, which was all right, y'all. Hold up, damn it. It was enough that they did what they did on their own. But there were many gatekeepers and barriers in their face. This record came out in December of 1968. So everybody put your thinking caps, because you got to remember where you were and, more importantly, what was on the air when you were doing it. Because I want to make the point that soul is not in a vacuum. And this is just as soulful as anything I've heard anywhere else. We're going to put together the soul map. So y'all come on with me. We start our journey not in New York, not in Chicago, not in Detroit, but in New Bedford, Massachusetts, where Chubby and the Turnpikes are jamming. They've become popular locally, and it was clear that they were getting a lot of action, but something was missing. And a name like Chubby and the Turnpikes is like the kind of band that you might hire for a high school dance, but not for a real gig in a music hall. So they decided to use their family name, and Chubby and the Turnpikes became Tavares. And the Tavares brothers made a nice little career for themselves. Moving on down the line, we stop in Providence, Rhode Island, and we meet one Jeffrey Osborne. Jeffrey Osborne with a smooth voice, mellow baritone, and falsetto. He put together a group of people who called themselves Love, Togetherness, and Devotion, LTD. And they did all right for themselves as well. Now, Tony, we get to your neck of the woods at New Haven, Connecticut. And an interesting thing happened with a local group there that called themselves Steam. Would you like to elaborate?
No, you go ahead, man. This is yours. I'm enjoying. Go ahead.
How old were you when Steam came out?
Let me see. What are we talking? 68, 69, right?
Yeah.
Right. Just think 68.
So 68. I was the ripe old age of six.
Exactly. Now, Steam was a bunch of studio musicians and a producer who got in the booth and started fooling around. They came on a nice little hook, and the song called Kissing Goodbye was developed. The hook was effective, and it was na 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 na. Goodbye. Now it was a cute song.
You couldn't hide from that song when it was. I mean, especially here. But you know, hey, it's you know, not to go too far off, but it's interesting. There's a lot of great acts that, you know, I think everybody's thinking, you know, the Carpenters also came out into the Haven, and also. There was an obscure singer who floated around New Haven and also in Connecticut, and he made a pretty good name for himself. Some guy by the name of some guy named Frankie Beverly, I think he's done okay.
Yeah, I heard of him.
I think he's done okay for himself.
He's done okay. Well, this. What is the question about white artists doing soul music? Now, this may not have been as evident in New Haven, Connecticut, but in New York City, at my soul station, WWRL, the program director was at odds with this. They were actually having issue with playing the song because a white group was singing it. Now, I don't know how passionate an argument it was, because eventually they said play it, and they did. So it became a fair compli after all that. But the bottom line was that it was issue in the first place. We now go from Tony's home in New Haven down to New York State. We started the western part of the state first because in Buffalo, New York, shit was cooking out there. Over where my brother Pat Freeman lives, there was a man named R. Lester Christian. His nickname was Dyke, and his band was called Dyke and the Blazers. Dyke and the Blazers did a song called We Got More Soul and Funky Broadway. They did the original version of Funky Broadway, and oh, it was funky. Dirty Funky Broadway. Messy ass Broadway. It was funky.
I can smell it from here.
For real. And so anyway, as the smell and the soul was going on, they carried that sound with them, and they came up with another hit, We Got More Soul, which was so funky, it got embraced and did a Latin version. Thank you, Mongo Santa Maria. But meanwhile, we get to New York City. And New York City is in a weird space. In 1968, you got a little bit of everything going on. You have the strong Latin influence from the Boogaloo Grooves, Pete Conde Rodriguez, doing I Like It Like That. Yeah, baby, I like it like that.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. There's a Joe Cuba with Bang Bang Beep Beep. Patrick will remember that shit. Ah, Beep Beep. And then there was the Latin triumvirate of Joe Patan, Rafi Pagan, and Hector Rivera. And they did these great ballads and grooves and stuff. Rafi Pagan is known for an awesome version of Make It With You. That was a slow, slow, awesome ballad. Brett could never come up with something like that. The soul infected it in the best way possible. It was an awesome song. But as that was going on, there was also just regular soul going on. There were local groups that were getting over, like the Main Ingredient. And this was even after their lead singer had died and Cuba Gooding took over. And, of course, you know, everybody plays the fool, all that from there. There were other bands that were New York-based, like Cameo, the Wilson Brothers, we're doing stuff, funky stuff, and they became Mandrill. And there was so much stuff in New York, the New York stations had decided that we didn't even freeze out. In New York, you had three major record labels. You had Epic, you had Columbia, and you had Atlantic. And if your artist did not record for either one of those records or those labels, you didn't get played on New York radio unless you were an independent you got on there and you sold so many that they couldn't ignore you. That's where the crossover phase came from. And we had crossover artists. We had Bloodstone, who did Natural High, but that was later in the 70s. But yet artists like the Sand Pebbles and others who did stuff, and they gave you some funk and stuff, early funk, to go with the soul that was out here. And remember, in New York, there was a big scandal that happened in the 50s with Frankie Lyman and the Teenagers. Frankie and Timothy Lyman lived in the neighborhood on 165th Street between Edgecombe and Amsterdam. And Timothy Lyman and the Teenagers was a big hit. They were local stars and celebrities and whatnot, and they went to school with my older brothers and sister. As all this was going on and the business was swallowing them up, other small acts were getting their little 15 minutes of fame, but that's all they were getting, as the record labels, in particular Roulette Records, was ripping them off. As this carried on, there was so much going on musically that you couldn't help but notice that across the way in New Jersey, there were other things going on.
In New Jersey,
I've been getting there, Gary, but wait a minute. You're in Philly. Hold up. In New Jersey, in Englewood, New Jersey, the All Platinum labels were being created. All Platinum was the brainchild of one Cynthia Robinson. And Miss Robinson, of course, was the lady in Pillow Talk. I said Cynthia, I was wrong. Sylvia Robinson was the mistress and leader, CEO inspiration behind All Platinum. That was Stang Records, Turbo, and a couple other subsidiary labels. But she was the focus. She was responsible for groups like The Moments, The Whatnots, Elmo Mills, Linda Jones, and other artists. And she did some amazing music with not very much to work with. They had a studio that cranked out music, but everything always sounded like it had been played already. So you'd buy the record brand new, but it would sound like it was crispy, like it had been played over and over and over again before it even hit the turntable. Either way, it was black owned and was black and good. So we liked that sort of thing. There were other labels that were springing up, other independent labels and other talent that were indicative of the industry. Now remember, all this is going on at the same time Jason and the Epics did that song. In Jersey City, a bunch of brothers who called themselves Scientists of Sound were getting down, and they were doing amazing stuff. As a matter of fact, I got caught one day. My cousins live in Asbury Park, New Jersey, and I used to go see them often. I came down there one day off the bus from New York, and they said, Mike, you got to hear this. Literally ran from the bus stop back to the house, and I heard what was eventually Kool & the Gang. Kool & the Gang was an instrumental group out of Jersey City, and these guys were fantastic. They could play anything and everything. And it was like, shit, I can't stop listening to this thing. We used to play it to death, and we played it to death that whole weekend. But they were also part of a separate sound that was coming down that was specifically them. And this is in Jersey City. There were other acts that came out, Brother to Brother. I'm sitting there scratching my brain, and my head hurts. But there were other groups who came out. Gary, what do you remember most about your early days and the sound that you grew up with?
Well, I'll tell you about Kool & Gang. Kool & Gang also came in South Jersey.
Uh-huh.
And they played in South Jersey a lot.
Uh-huh.
Probably They're taking home. They've only been really well in Jersey.
Mm-hmm.
I'm always going to see them play. I was there to play outside in the open in Williamsburg, New Jersey. I loved it.
Well, that's just it. They were out there, and they were also out of the New York influence. And that was important because the soul was so powerful, you couldn't stop it. Like I said, in New York, you had Columbia, Atlantic, and Epic Records. If those guys did not play or sing for either one of those labels, you weren't getting heard on New York radio. You had to force your way in. And ironically, Atlantic, which had always played what they considered race music, black artists, signed a white act who called themselves the Young Rascals. They were amazing. They did stuff that was kind of offbeat, but
yep.
They did some down-home soul, like How Can I Be Sure, and Groovin', and A Girl Like You. And their lead singer, Felix Cavalieri, was a real poet on the in the manner of Smokey and other great lyricists like that. He put together some really great music. And they were the first white act to be signed by Atlantic Records. So, again, New York's got shit going on, but if it wasn't for the soul stations, it wouldn't be hot because the soul stations were cooking even more. We had Jimmy Castor, who lived in my neighborhood, not far from me on 168th and thereabouts. He had the Calypso. Yep. He had the Calypso influence with the song Hey Leroy, Your Mama's Been Calling You. Or Your Mama's Calling You, I should say.
Yeah.
And there were other acts, Eddie Palmieri. Ray Barreto was doing mostly instrumental at the time, but El Watusi had been a hit. If you remember the movie JFK, that was some of the music that was playing as they were talking about the conspiracy to kill his ass. But either way, it was so popular, it was on the mainstream station. And there was no explanation other than it sold so much they couldn't ignore it. So now we're in New Jersey. We got other groups like the Family Circle, Continental Four, doing this great music and singing this good stuff, providing us with upbeat soul, but also now tapping into a market that had heretofore been undiscovered, and that is that of sexy soul, where they did ballads. Not just ballads, we're talking full works of art, which takes us to Philadelphia. Philadelphia was the first true music city. And in 1968, there were groups that were doing work. But what made Philly different from New York was the fact that if you were from Philly, you were lifted up. In other words, if Tony and Gary were part of a music group, they were local kids. They got played on the local stations. That was not the case in New York, although there were guys like John Sebastian who got played because he was from New York, loving Spoonful and all that. But Philadelphia was a true music city. You had the Intruders.
Yep.
You had the Delphonics.
Yep.
You had the Futures and others.
Yep.
And they all worked under the premise of we represent Philadelphia. That was the difference. A Philly
yep.
group represented the city. You didn't get that feeling from New York. But it didn't matter what kind of music you were doing. If you're from Philly, that's all they wanted to hear.
And you know, Michael,
yeah.
Jaco Anderson, Jerry Babbitt, Georgie Wood, and Eddie B. Made it sure you knew they were from Philadelphia.
That was the other part of the equation. I'm glad you asked that. I'm glad you said that, G. Because the radio personalities made it a bigger scene. In New York, you had jockeys who were really personal. Disc jockeys like Bruce Marl, Cousin Brucey, Scott Muni.
And then Bruce.
But in Philadelphia, you had guys like Georgie Woods, the guy with the goods.
Yeah.
And their idea was let the music speak for itself. And it did. It wasn't until 1968, the same year that The Intruders came out with Cowboys the Girls.
The Girls, get there.
And the co-writers, Gamble and Huff, had the seed money they needed to start Philadelphia International Records. So Philly is cooking. In addition, there were also venues that all the soul acts could work it. Now, it was part of what was called the Chitlin Circuit. Tony, if a group was going to New Haven, where would they play?
Oh, wow. From the 6 feet, well, let me think. Well, you had the old New Haven Arena, which was basically a 3,000, maybe 4,000 if the fire department wasn't looking to sneak in there. You had like the Monterey over in, which is not too far from where I'm at. This was more so for the and we also had a place called the Cotton Club. And
okay.
The Cotton Club Cotton Club was on the border of New Haven and Hamden. Sort of imagine like I guess say this is like St. Paul and Minneapolis. I mean, and St. Paul Minneapolis Minnesota. I'm sorry. And let me think. Now later on, and this was more of like in the like the 70s or like around the time when I was in college, and I think folks know of this place called Toad's Place. Toad's Place was you could get rock, you could get soul, you could get rap, matter of fact, I actually saw in college, Public Enemy there live when I was in college. But what was interesting was the opening act was this group called Leaders of the New School. And their lead singer, of course, was a guy by the name of Busta Rhymes.
That's right.
Now, later on in the 70s, after the arena got knocked down, we had the New Haven Coliseum, and the Coliseum did about 12,000-15,000 on a good night. You had hockey, but all kinds of acts came here. Stevie Wonder, Earth, Wind & Fire. Mm-hmm. Now, later on, just in the late 70s, early 80s, Hartford decided to do stuff. And they had, of course, the Hartford Civic Center, which is now still up now. And now I went to a concert there years again, college. All I did in college was go to concerts and go to class. But we saw the Gap Band, Sister Sledge, Function.
That was a good show.
Oh, yeah. But, just to keep it in New Haven, you had places like the Agora Ballroom. Now we also have a Schubert Theater here as well. But there were a lot of different places. There's been places that, there were places that were here for like years and years and years, but then they closed down. But everybody came through here. Now, the most infamous thing that happened here in New Haven was, of course, the Jim Morrison and the Doors incident when he actually got arrested here in the city. And if you've ever seen the movie The Doors, it's well chronicled. And if you're a fan
It's well chronicled what happened here. And yes, right. the New Haven cops are just as crooked as you think they are. But that's another two Kool-Aid drink that we can talk about down the road. But yeah, the more and more I hear you reminisce and everything like that, it got me my mind to thinking. It's like a lot of
I'm glad that you mentioned ballrooms. Ballrooms were also a big part of the scene back in the day because they were cheaper to rent than other places. They held smaller, but they had chances to be, how can I say, sleep a bit more often because the ballrooms were on a date basis. So you had to get them if they were available that day. You couldn't book very much in advance because the ones that did exist, they got filled up quickly.
Oh, yeah.
And
oh, yeah.
It was also part of the scene in terms of places where guys could play.
Mm.
In New York, of course, you had the Apollo Theater, but there was a network of places. Just like you mentioned in New Haven, there was a place in New Haven where the promoter could go, promoters, or you could go to the place like the Regal in Chicago where Gene Chandler was like the house tiger. You could go to the Fox Theater in Detroit where the Motown Review was in effect with Motel. You could go to the Howard Theater
and
watch.
And is it that theater in Detroit? Isn't that still in downtown Detroit too?
I think the Fox still exists, yes.
Because I'm imagining that right next to Joe Louis's Fist in downtown Detroit.
That's right. You got the Howard Theater in Washington, D.C., where acts from the Baltimore and D.C. area will perform. You got the Uptown in Philly, where, of course, the Philly acts will do their thing. And the Apollo in New York City, where, of course, Patti LaBelle, the Bluebells, were the house act.
Mm.
So when nobody else showed up, Patti and the Bluebells would tear the stage up, and she would run all over the place and start kicking and screaming and acting like a fool, but sounding so damn good, nobody mattered. So Philly was the first of the great music cities. You had white groups like the Dovells doing stuff that was considered pop soul. And then their lead singer, Len Barry, did 1, 2, 3. All of a sudden, they crossed over. And Philly is officially a music city. Now, as we move on in Philly, you had other groups. I talked about how the Intruders did their thing. But the Dolphonics have a special place on their own, as the Hart Brothers, Randy Kane, Major Harris, they all became the Dolphonics.
Yep.
And the sound that they generated was one of a kind. It was called Sexy Soul, and it led itself to a whole new genre where they, in the moment, were at the forefront of it. As a matter of fact, they used to battle each other in battle. And the Bovis, the Dolphonics, used to tear up the area in terms of popularity and who was better. And they gave great shows, and they got great responses. More importantly, the Dolphonics...
Michael, what was interesting about that was When we went to East St. Louis, Illinois, and I would bring my records with me to Illinois.
I'm going to get to East St. Louis. We haven't forgotten, but we're still in Philly right now. The Moments, the Dolphonics, they led part of this sexy soul thing. And it changed how people listened to the radio because now these beautiful ballads were being concocted by the Moments and the Delphonics, especially Tom Bell, who arranged for a lot of their music. His neoclassical influences were making the Delphonics a powerful force, and they broke into the charts with La La Beans, I Love You, in the same year that Jason and the Epics did King Size. So now here they are on the main stations in New York. They've crossed over, which means they sold a lot of records, and now you're getting played in New York. Although, if you're in Philly, you are guaranteed to get good music. Just like with my cousin, I heard music in Philly that I didn't hear in New York until weeks later, if at all. And that's because of the fact that if you didn't record for the big three, you didn't get played. But that's another story for another time. As we move on from Philadelphia, we go down the turnpike into Baltimore, where we have groups like the Whatnots, the President, now, forgive me because I'm doing this off the cuff. So I'm trying to remember who was there.
Who was the group that did that did Juju Shine?
Oh, that's the Dynamic Superiors. Yes.
Yeah.
The Dynamic Superiors.
Gary, your age is showing.
Yes. Now, you must understand, while Jason and the Epics are doing this, they're dealing with opposition from gatekeepers in Vancouver. How do I know this? I know this because if you're local, you should be getting played. If you're local, you know, the DJs would say, hey, these guys are from our town, blah, 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 give them a hand on, let's give them support. It wasn't like that in Vancouver. Jason was too black for them, and even though the Epics were all white except for Jason, they still didn't get the love that they were supposed to get. I once asked Jason if Vancouver had ever played a James Brown song. Now, I don't mean, you know, Get Up or Money Won't Change or any other stuff, or Say It Loud, I'm Black and I'm Proud. Just Even I Feel Good. I mean, the simplest I Feel Good. If they ever played that. And he said, no. I asked my wife if she ever heard of James Brown 2 on Vancouver radio. And she's a ham radio enthusiast. She said no. But Jason said, if you turned on the Seattle station, he was there. So we know they were steering. The Pacific Northwest was a lot more racist than people thought. Jason even said there were black and white water fountains there. And this is Seattle. So there was shit going on that a lot of folks don't want to cop but to. So we go from Philly to Baltimore, Baltimore to D.C., the Choice Four, the Whatnots, I'll Erase Away Your Pain. I'll Erase Away Your Pain. That was a big song. But we also had the Court of Love with the Unifics. The Unifics were well known for wearing the white gloves as they did their act.
Yes,
they were nice to look at. And the brothers, of course, could sing. Moving on, we get past D.C. as we head slightly south. We lean in toward Memphis. We know in Memphis there was a lot of shit going on. Unfortunately, Otis had just sung his last song in 67 as he died in a plane crash with several members of the Barcades. But the Savior is in the house, and they didn't even know it. Isaac Hayes came on the dust pile, and like the phoenix, he rose from the ashes and injected a new life into everything in Memphis. All of a sudden, it was about Shaft. I knew his brother Schiff, but I knew his brother Shaft as well.
Okay. He was a bad something something. The last I heard.
So we had that. We also had groups like the Mad Lads, who were teenagers at Memphis, who went to high school together, and they did a nice mix of soul and doo-wop. You had the Dramatics, who were doing some sexy soul as well as doing pop soul. The Soul Children. There were several acts that made it the so-called Memphis Sound.
And wasn't the big? Now you said you're gonna say Stack, but there was another company, if I remember correctly, called Malico Records.
That's right. They do stuff that was what they call Deep South oriented. Well, Dorothy Moss was singing that label.
Bobby Blue Bland.
They did the kind of stuff that my family would call down home music.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know who's home, but it sounded good.
I remember Rufus Thomas and I believe his sister Carla Thomas or cousin or something like
daughter.
That.
That was his daughter.
That was his daughter. Thank you. I knew they were related in some way or fashion. I just couldn't remember which way.
I remember those pink hot pants. And the fashion police they should have shot his ass on sight there, chick.
Hey everybody. Mr. Rufus in town. I got a brand new dance.
That's right. Doing the funky chicken.
Mm-hmm.
I definitely remember doing the funky chicken. And of course, speaking of dancing, this was a time where you had dancers coming in from everywhere. You had the jerk, the duck, the karate, the shingling, the boogaloo.
couldn't do either one of them.
Escape. But the DJs infected the life of soul by constantly playing the music and constantly reveling in the culture. So we loved all that. We had a crucial point as we go from Memphis all the way down south to Florida, where one Clarence Reed resides. Now, Clarence Reed made a couple of hits for himself, but he's more known by his persona, Blowfly. Blowfly did X-rated versions of songs. And, well, because this is a PG show, I can't say some of the lyrics. Suffice to say, he did all right. And he helped a lot of the Miami acts and a lot of the Florida acts do okay into the 70s and into the disco era. He was one of the unsung heroes, and he should be recognized as such. But we move back up the timeline and back up the map to Ohio. And Ohio, in many ways, is the birthplace of funk and R&B. Ohio had, in his name, King Records. King Records was the home of James Brown and Little Willie Jay. Now, in that day, Little Willie John was the headliner. As a matter of fact, James Brown used to open up for him. But by 68, the roles had reversed. And James said, with your bad self, say it loud. I'm talking about and next thing you know, people were walking down the street bopping, feeling the beat of that. I can remember that shit.
My mother hated James Brown. She couldn't stand James Brown.
Oh, no.
Wait, let me tell you a story.
Did he owe her money?
Black and brown, you know. She said, okay. He's okay.
So my great had to hear James Brown sing Black and I'm Proud first.
Yep, sure did.
I believe that, too. I believe my great did not play. I believe she'd have chased James with the soap. So, but the song itself was an overall flattering and love note to black people in general that you loved what you saw in the mirror. And we did not mind Black and Proud. As a matter of fact, we loved it. It was time to go and get the Afro Sheen, the Ultra Sheen, get your pit phone. You know, that's exactly right.
Oh, yeah.
It's funny. We had a subscription to Ebony and Jet. It seems like everyone, and of course, Black America had one. So
I couldn't wait
for Jim Maggie to come out. And if you believe that, I've got some land in Beirut you might be interested in.
No shit. He's looking at the Fox of the Week. But definitely, I was looking forward to. Meanwhile, in Ohio, you go from Cincinnati to Dayton. And Dayton has become the birthplace of funk. All the good shit that came out of Dayton, Ohio. Lakeside. Slave. The Ohio Untouchables. If you buy the song Where is the Party by Helena Ferguson, the background music was done by a group called the Ohio Untouchables, who eventually became, as you all know, the Ohio Players.
The Agora Ballroom that I had mentioned a little while back. Saw them live there at the old Agora Ballroom, and
there you go.
The Agora Ballroom, and you know, like you said, it doubled as a movie theater, as well.
Yeah.
Matter of fact, let me tell you how crazy it is. I saw Ohio Players at the Agora Ballroom, but then I also on a Saturday would go see the original Frankenstein and the original Dracula double feature for 99 cents.
Exactly. Same building. That's why we point these ballrooms out as venues, but we want to make the point that the reason they were there in those neighborhoods was to provide sources of entertainment where people could go locally and see a show and watch a movie or go to a concert. And it was like an event. It was like dressing up and going out. But it was also a lifeline because that band was going to play, they were going to play New Haven. They were also going to play Philly in the Uptown or Detroit in the Fox or Chicago in the Regal and come back to the Apollo. You can't make money as a band, and I say this from experience, you cannot make money as a band unless you're playing live. That's how you sing for your supper. So it was important to these groups that dollars turned over by them being able to perform in these local places, in these venues, be they ballrooms or halls, because a lot of the halls, like the Apollo, Uptown, et cetera, they only had 1,000 to 1,500 seat capacity. So it was like you were there. If you're there, you're hedged in or hemmed in. Sometimes it's standing room only, but you got in. My first concert was James Brown, Volume 3, Live at the Apollo. That was the one which turned out to be Revolution of the Mind. What can I say? James was on fire doing what he did. But in Ohio, Dayton became another center for bands to get off. You had the Ohio Players, Lakeside, Faiso, Slave, and more and more of these as we went from the 60s into the 70s. It became the base for funk. It really did. And as we go from Ohio to Chicago, we have kind of those banging-ass Shalites. Yes, those guys operated their knee pads on. Have you seen them? Yes, they would cry and beg for it. I'm sure they got more pussy by default than any other group. Here, take it. Just stop it. You know they did that, guys. In addition to the Shylights.
Michael, one thing. I noticed that the Chicago crew, I went to SIU in Carbondale. It was about 8 hours from Chicago.
Right.
And I would bring my Philadelphia records, and they would say, we never heard these records before. And it always seems to be how it happened.
Well, that was more regional than anything else, because I'm sure they heard of them. They just didn't play them. And there's
a big difference.
There's a big difference there. In Chicago, you had Jerry Butler, Curtis Mayfield, Gene Chandler. You had giants of soul who putting out product, and they had people who followed them. You had a very young Minnie Riperton singing with the Gems before she came out of her own. Fontella Bass singing Rescue Me.
Rescue Me!
Chicago had a song all by itself, but the Mighty Mighty Dells also resided in Chicago.
Mighty Mighty Dells.
And they were doing things that no other group had done, because they did Oh What a Night in the 50s, and it was a hit. They brought it back again 10 years later, and they made their number one soul hit. To a lesser degree, they had done the same thing with Stay in My Corner. It was done 10 years before, and they came out with it again and became a huge hit. As a matter of fact, it was even bigger the second time around. The Dells, they were a great musical organization, over 50 years together. At the time, I met a couple of members of the group. The Five Heartbeats had just come out. The Five Heartbeats was loosely dedicated to the Dells and Delphonics and other groups of that time, the 60s soul genre. And I was glad that they finally got in the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame. You know, we campaigned long and hard for them, and they got it. And they should have got it. They deserved to get it. But in Chicago, that's the kind of music you heard. You might have heard every now and then Inez and Charlie Fox, Barbara Lynn, A.V. Light, and others. But basically in Chicago, those guys were the guys. The Impressions were the embodiment of them. You had Jerry Butler, Curtis Mayfield, fronting this group, The Impressions. Later on, after Curtis went solo, Johnny Ellis came on and a different sound to them. But Chicago was laying down a bluesy sound. You also had VJ Records, which was the first home of the Beatles. VJ Records, a black label, played the Beatles for the first time in the States before all kinds of legal wrangling started and somebody else got the rights to it. But you heard them first there through VJ. VJ did mostly blues and stuff. And if you saw the movie Cadillac Records, a lot of artists like VJ went through this mythical label. It was also, if you had any Chess or Checker records for that label, you were also influenced by Cadillac Records. Go further up into Detroit, and you have the beginnings of Motown. But by that time, by 1968, Motown was losing its grip. They were advertising themselves as the sound of young America, but the sound wasn't as fresh, and America was going through changes because...
Well, Michael, they tried to appeal to white America. Everybody wrote.
Well, that came out in the Five Heartbeats. They showed how they did album covers with white people on it, where they tried to whitewash the sound.
Yeah, that's what I mean, yeah.
They couldn't change the singers, but they changed the packaging. And it bothered some of the artists for sure.
Yeah,
but they got played, eventually. They got played. And unfortunately, some of the handlings were a little unscrupulous. So they got played, and that was not good either. But Motown tried to hedge their bets. They did what we call mid-tempo. They did songs that were nice to listen to, but they didn't have much teeth. We talk about the ballads, and as much as I love Smokey Robinson, he was a great lyricist, but the songs... I wasn't a Smokey fan. I listened to them, they were nice, but I wasn't a Smokey fan. Now, Motown didn't get my attention that way until the originals did Baby I'm For Real. Because it's the first time where I think a Motown artist was begging for it. But when the originals say, "Cause you're real," they were begging. They would have dropped them draws. You got to be able to beg. You have to be able to beg. And while we're hanging over in Motown, I got to point out East St. Louis, Illinois, was also the home of the Montclairs. Phil Perry was a great lead singer, but they had one of the best titles in all of soul music. Begging is hard to do. And believe me, it is. But they seem to do a very good job of it. But meanwhile, in Detroit, it wasn't just about Motown. You had labels like RCA, you had groups like New Birth. You had other smaller labels who produced the songs. There was Rick Tick that had the Detroit Emeralds and Edwin Starr.
Edwin Starr, oh yes.
Asian Double O Soul. And you had Revelo with Parliament singing I Want to Testify. If there's anything as a first funk song, I Want to Testify would be close to it. As a matter of fact, Jason did I Want to Testify as one of the songs when he performed in Canada nationwide. And when I first heard it, I was like, oh, shit, get it, Jason. because it was the kind of song that not everybody's going to take off. I mean, can you imagine what would have happened if George Clinton had signed with Motown?
Oh, man. He would have got crushed.
Yeah, think about it. That's right. I think they would have stifled George Clinton. He wouldn't have been able to become the genius that he is.
No.
So he wouldn't have gotten away with as much artistically.
No.
At Motown, it seemed like they made classics by accident. Now, we know about My Girl. And because of the song, probably more babies were made to My Girl than any real love song because it was exposed as long as it was. I mean, My Girl is what? How many years old? So over 60 years old.
Yeah.
So by volume alone, they probably made more babies. And then, of course, What's Going On did its due. But the song that was most important, Does Your Mama Know About Me? Does Your Mama Know About Me was made by Bobby Taylor, who also recorded for Motown. He had a group who called themselves Bobby Taylor and the Vancouvers. They were from Vancouver. He's repping his hometown. And they still got treated like shit. Now, the song Does Your Mother Know About Me, you got the impression that it was a black kid begging somebody's parents to let them see their daughter because she was white. But there's nothing close to that. Does Your Mama Know About Me was written by Tommy Chong, who was Asian. He was in love with a black girl, and he had to beg to the parents for the right to see her. Of course, if you ever saw Ray Dong Chong, you know what happened. So he must have been successful. But the point is,
Ray Dong Chong is a fine-looking lady.
Well, the point is, if black people had known that about the song, the song would have had even more importance.
Yeah.
And a lot of little black girls would have felt even better knowing that, hey, I'm worth it. You know, look at these guys did for me. Or look at this guy singing about. This is the same effect that I think Black Pearl must have. Because he praised the beauty of our women in that song and make their side that, well, they don't want you winning any beauty contests because they're not used to your beauty or how you look and stuff like that. But we love you. Other groups who worked Motown trying to make it. New Birth was one of them. Now, there was a big group.
That's a long time.
That instrumental piece called The Nightlighters that had become popular. They also had a separate group about Peace and Happiness, which also did some stuff, but they all performed together. And when they sang as a group, they're about 16 pieces, which was a really big band. And we know at that time, size doesn't matter. They were able to get away with that. Although later on in the 70s, a lot of bands cut down in size. I got to remind you, remember, this is all happening in 68. The riots in Detroit in 67 was making Motown change their mind about some things. And they decided that we should change our operations and move. And they were moving to California.
California.
That's when we get the Invictus and Hot Wax labels. But we ain't got there yet. So Detroit had all this stuff going on. We go further, not across, but down south. and you had two major labels turned out soul. You had Dial and Duke. They covered the deep south. Artists like Joe Tech and Bobby Blue Bland played off these albums, on these labels rather, and they generated soul there. You go back up, and the map is pretty much covered until we get to Los Angeles, where we had the Righteous Brothers doing the blue-eyed soul. We also have Bill Withers doing this inspired folk soul music, which got him noticed and got him on the map, folk songs and soul music, but more of an instrumental frame, troubadour style. Original work that got people's attention. You also had underground hits and artists like Jesse James, who did songs like I Need You and I Can Do Bad By Myself. All this is Southern California. We go up to Northern California and we get the Natural Four, which shocked me in 1968 when I heard them saying, Why Should We Stop Now? I swore this group was from back east. The fact that WWRL was playing this on their station was an indication of just how powerful soul was. Because
they carried Tower of Power?
Yeah. You didn't hear it anywhere else. These were the contributions that the black stations made. They made sure that artists got paid, but also that artists got played. And I don't mean played in a bad sense. They got exposure. It was important that these artists got what they got and got the chance to be heard. And this is before rumors of payola or any other kind of thing came into play. Because it was about a pay-for-play situation that put some people in jeopardy, Frankie Crocker among them. He managed to land on his feet and he became a solid force for radio in the 80s. So now we're in California. All this is established. You got Axel Child Power to come. Sly and Family Stone, of course, represented San Francisco and Oakland. You had other white acts like Deep Purple and Paul Revere and the Raiders also doing soul-like stuff. And that brings us back to Vancouver. So we know Sly and Stone and Family Stone was doing dance to the music and all this other good stuff at the same time. We know soul was strong on the West Coast. And now, here's Jason trying to make the point and do soul in Vancouver. It wasn't happening. It wasn't happening because they didn't want it to happen. They wanted him to suppress the sound, and they wanted him to succumb to the wishes of gatekeepers and become like a little Goldberg. They wanted him to adopt a Jewish persona. They even said as much. It was crazy. Why would you do that? He was good enough just as he was. He had to be Jewish. It was if I'll guarantee your success if you decide to go Jewish. That's kind of fucked up. He didn't do it, but don't think they didn't dangle the carrot in front of it. After the 60s, he changed the name of the group that he was in to the Trials of Jason Hoover. And Jason decided which direction he was going to go. Decided it was more important than anything to make sure he had his own thing.
Proton therapy targets difficult-to-treat cancer, prostate cancer, which may lead to fewer side effects and better quality of life during treatment. Unlike life-saving cancer treatments, come to them now to help care leaders.
Now here you have a true conundrum. Here you have a Canadian artist, Canadian born and bred, and he's turning out real soul music. You would think, Gary, that Canada would jump on this, because up to then, we hadn't really heard true soul music coming out of Canada. You dig in Canada back then, you know, Anne Murray did a little country thing with that song Snowbird. And yet Rush as probably the first Canadian rock band to get any real notice and stuff like that. Gino Vannelli out of Montreal, he would become popular in the late 70s and 80s, and he was good, but nothing that was true soul. Jason was true soul, and he was right in their faces, and they couldn't stand the fact that he was there. Which brings me back to Bobby Taylor. Now, Bobby Taylor sadly died before Jason did. But a lot of people don't know this. Bobby Taylor was given credit for discovering the Jackson 5. And that's the true story. Wasn't any of Diana Ross bullshit or Berry Gordy. Bobby Taylor first saw the Jackson 5, and he told Berry Gordy, sign these guys. And Bobby Taylor was responsible for producing the first four or five Jackson 5 albums. And all of them went at least gold. So Bobby Taylor knew what he was doing. But unfortunately, being from Vancouver, the local media treated him like a red-headed stepchild. They tried to make him sound like he was some sort of BS artist. And after he died, they wanted to afterwards grudgingly admit he was responsible for the Jackson 5. So it's the same racist bullshit that we run into. A black act or a black singer not getting credit for what his true influence was and the impact that he made. Now, Jason was tied with other acts in Vancouver, like the Midnight Train Review and Soul Unlimited. Now, these were other acts who were performing. They were performing separately for what Jason and the Epics were doing. They maybe were not as good, but with Jason and Bobby as a foundation, they had a chance to generate of Vancouver South. And this should have been something that Vancouver jumped on. Unfortunately, they did not do it. And because of that, you got to call them out for the racist bullshit that they were. Unfortunately, he's not alive to bear the fruits of this. But it really is backed up that it's gotten to that point. But I think what bothers me more was the fact that you had all this racial shit going on in the Pacific Northwest. I had no idea it was so bad that there were black and white fountains, water fountains in Seattle. That's kind of scary.
Well, we were in Wyoming in 1969. And the radio there, rock and roll radio station.
Yeah.
They played one hour of soul music every day. I was really? No, seriously, it was in every Wyoming, every night at 7 o'clock. It was called a soul hour.
Really?
And after the show hour, they go back to regular programming.
Wow.
You did not hear black music on one hour.
Well, that's probably an indication of how often people wanted to hear it. And even that, they couldn't ignore the popularity of it. Now, because of that, you brought up to the conversation. Another point. It's like, why would you not play the stuff people would appeal to? Why would you not just play the music and, hey, you know what? Let folks listen to it and make up their own mind. But we know it doesn't work like that.
I was shocked because I was like, Come up,
exactly.
You gotta be kidding me.
And as you can hear, Jason did ballots, but he also had his moments in terms of being thought-provoking with lyrics. Sadly, you don't get to see this often enough. Now we know she's your lady. Sorry. We know she's your lady. You're trying to get something else on here. But Vancouver decided that it was more important to stick with a format rather than push a local guy. That would never happen in the American city. They would say, you know what? This guy's good. We should let him play. And unfortunately, we didn't get that. That's sad. As we listen to this, Jason, representing soul music, is treated like a redheaded child in Vancouver. If he did country, he probably would be tolerated the way Charlie Pride was tolerated when he was doing country early on. You know, I remember Gino Vannelli being on Soul Train, and Soul Train didn't put you on unless you were soulful. It was probably him and maybe four or five of the white acts that ever got on it. So.
And Casey and the Sunshine Band. The group of San Francisco. Michael McDonald group.
Doobie Brothers.
Yeah, the Doobie Brothers.
Yep. But they were out. They were out to make a point. These guys were like, "This is our radio. We control it. We're not putting you on." Mm-hmm. It's kind of fucked up. It's like, why would you do that? Why would you purposely suppress when you know the guys, when the guy's doing work, yeah, when the music is good, and he's one of you? It's like, I can remember doing radio on station CITR Vancouver.
Mm-hmm.
It was a college station, and you had to play what they were called Canadian content. You had to play X number of Canadian songs or Canadian artists to fill the quota. And I
that was interesting because the TV channels,
yep,
in Canada did the same thing. You had to have X number of hours of Canadian TV. You could have American TV. It was very interesting to me.
Mm-hmm. Oh, you know, I didn't mind it. It was good to hear. But they kicked themselves in the ass because,
yeah, yeah,
you're like, well, this has potential.
Yeah.
In Vancouver, there really weren't many places where you could play. If you were trying to, say, start a band, if you were not playing in a band, there were so many places we could play. And if you got to the established places, there were a couple people who regulated which clubs you got the chance to play in. Vancouver was racist for a long time. I have to say this because it's part of its ugly truth. The great Louis Armstrong was banned from playing in Vancouver. That's a saxophone. This is the 50s, and in Vancouver, there were two main hotels, the Hotel Georgia and the Hotel Vancouver. And they did not want Louis to play. The only reason he eventually did get to play was because of his name. Other than that, get your black ass out of here. We don't want to hear it. And I have to add, if I flip back to the States for a hot second, the same thing happened in New Orleans. Here's a city which prides itself on being a so-called music city, but New Orleans was just as guilty. They were actually advocating, do not play these nigger records on the radio. They said it just like that. It's like, how the fuck can you call yourself a music city? Yet artists like Professor Longhair and Eddie Bo and the Meters do unique music, and you're saying in the same breath, don't listen to this because these niggas are playing it. We don't want you buying their music. Fuck you. That's stupid.
No, that's the way America was back then.
Yeah. In that regard, I told New Orleans to fuck off because they didn't want to expand the culture. They were happy with just allowing us to carry on.
Yep.
Which is sad. But now, here we are. We got a situation where we got a singer who's doing unique stuff. He's doing original stuff. And he's Canadian born. He used to advertise himself as Canada's King of Soul. And that's exactly what he was. You would have thought they would jump on us with both feet. And saying, this guy's on. You know, if he was a hockey player, we have no problem with that. But because he was a singer, no, we don't want to do that. I'm confused. I'm more confused. I'm more angry than anything else because he was getting to the point where now all of a sudden people were discovering who he was. He passed away in November of last year, but earlier this month, the CBC did a little two-minute thing on him and the fact that his music was being played now. It's like, no, it's not. You wanted to find a spot talk about something black for Black History Month.
Yeah.
You give him a few seconds, but you didn't give a fuck about him. If you cared about him, you did this a long time ago. So what we're trying to do is make sure everybody remembers who Jason is and what he stood for and what he was trying to do. Because Jason was one of a kind. I think there are many artists who wanted to be on stage with someone that he had, and they didn't have it like that. Jason had it like that. He was naturally comfortable in front of the camera, and he made you get caught up in what he was doing. He was very good at what he did. So what do you think, my brother?
Well, I just think Canada, but America, if Canada really knew better, it's all about the dollar, right? And there was some way that those groups, those record companies, could make Canada a dollar. Trust me, it would change the whole concept.
It would, but
because they could not, because they couldn't make a dollar off these guys, and then we ain't doing nothing.
Well, I don't think it was so much about that. I think it was, you got to make a dollar for me. They wanted Jason to perform their certain set of things, and he wouldn't do it. And it's like, why should he have to? His version was good enough. It was all right being exactly who he was. And I can't get why some folks can't get past that.
Well, it's really strange. Because in the East, like Montreal and Ottawa is very open-minded.
Yeah.
But you go west, it's a very different attitude.
There might be truth to that. All I know is, if you're a local artist, you would think getting played on the local station would be easy if you were good. I'm not just talking about being fly by night. Jason was not good, he was great. And that makes a big difference when you're trying to make the point about what you can do and what you can't do. Unfortunately, we're not going to see that greatness come through yet. 3 years ago, there was efforts to start a documentary based on Jason's life, and I was fortunate enough to be a part of it. My brother David Love Jones came through with this. So I'm hoping to see the fruits of this labor come through soon. But I ask the question again, why would you deliberately stop yourself from opening up creative endeavor? Now, this is what these gatekeepers are doing. It's like, you must play our nightclubs or you don't get played. You must do this for us or you don't get played. It's like,
and that power control syndrome right there.
He was obviously good because he was where a lot of people feared the tread. Jason Hoover opened up for Led Zeppelin when nobody knew who the hell they were. It's documented.
Yep.
He opened up for other acts. But then that. And again, he's truly Canadian. I shouldn't be having to spend this much energy talking about him because he was Canadian born and bred. That should speak for itself. Unfortunately, it doesn't.
Well, like Professor Willis says, we got to tell our own history.
Well, I was saying this because I want everybody to know who Jason was, why he was doing what he was doing,
and what he was about. Jason Aaron was an amazing talent. And I think if we any kind of justice at all, you get a chance to tell his story, because he really was about it. He was an amazing talent. And this is why when we talk about Jason, in a few years, just maybe he will get the kind of stuff and the kind of credit that he should get, because he was awesome. So tell me, when it comes to soul, what do you think was the most important component in this soul map concept? Was the fact that it was all over the place, or was the fact that it started to grow in places we didn't expect it?
What soul was is a deep, deep emotional connection to the singer and the audience. What I mean is this. What the Delphites did?
Yeah.
The Delphites, when they come on stage, you knew what you were going to get.
You
knew what you were going to say. You knew how you were going to sing it.
Mm-hmm.
It made you feel good. It made you think of your girlfriend or boyfriend. It made you fall in love with the song.
That's true.
And that's really, you know, 68, 67, 68. That's why the Delphites today, 60 years later, is still strong.
And that's exactly why, hopefully someday, some Canadian kid will say the same thing about Jason Moore.
Yes.
You know,
yes.
if you love Drake, you might love this. Thank you.
hope you like the way that we presented today on Let's Go. I'm Jason Hoover. See you again.
You know, Jay Stino, guy, I'm more annoyed that they have him on the gameless takes. If you're not going to embrace the guy, don't embrace him all the way. If you are, leave him alone and let him share his talent with everybody. Later on, Jason would go totally funk, and he did an album in 1975, showcasing his true talent. It was well received, but of course, in Canada, they got the message late. It's like, why do you have to die to be appreciated?
Because they don't want to respect you. This is a worldwide thing. In England, France, Germany, America again. I think it's a sickness. It is a complete sickness.
Because you know what? You're not far wrong.
Denying good, rich music because of the cover of it.
You're not far wrong. I came to that conclusion a long time ago. It's like, give me a reason why. You know, if it makes half-ass sense, I can make an argument for or against it. But they didn't do that. They didn't do it because they didn't have to. And that's what bothers me so bad. The fact that...
The power that be in America, you had a black audience that said, look, we want this music, we want this group. That wasn't the case. I don't think that was the case in Canada.
No, I don't think it was the case. I don't think it was the case because it never got to that. They cut that off before it became an issue. There were people who said, we don't want this. And there were people who, after the fact, put their arm around and they said, yeah, I was this, I was that, and I was connected with it, but they didn't want to give it credit. I wrote a series about this called The Death of Rhythm and Blues in Vancouver.
Good article, unfortunately,
I talked about Jason and other acts.
If you came
to Vancouver, you were going to die a slow death unless you did something else. Came upon a live performance of a young lady who had a nice voice. She could sing with a little bit of soul, but she said straight out, I'm getting the fuck out of here. Me and my boyfriend, the lead guitarist, are going to go to Memphis. I'm going to try our luck there. I was like, Memphis? What's going on?
Yeah.
And because she knew there was nothing there for her.
Yeah.
That's embarrassing.
Well, that was the way it was in the 60s.
Yeah.
Michael, if it wasn't for the black companies in America, we wouldn't have heard of their minds. We wouldn't have heard of the Univics. It would happen.
You know, you're right. Sadly, you wouldn't have heard it. Fortunately, they were there. And we did hear it. But it's another day to have groups like the Dubphonics and the Moments and the Shylights, where they were in abundance. And it's another to have a single artist like this who the talent you can hear. And they suppressed the talent because they could.
Yep.
It's fucked up. Well, we're at the point where we got to go for now. Telling our own stories is supposed to be part of the cathartic feeling and being able to feel better knowing that you had the chance to say what you needed to say. Is there anything you want to add to this, brother?
I think you cover all the bases. A fine job. I hope this guy gets really recognized around the world because of his great music. I do want to say this. This week, Katie Cannon, whatever her name is, in Iowa, is going to so-called break the record.
Okay.
No, she's not. Because there's an AIWA basketball player who's got 4,135 points. Caitlin is 1,000 points behind her. So stop BS.
Well, you know they got to have something to talk about. So I know what you're saying. I don't think it's going to happen either. If it does, hooray for her. But the bottom line is greatness should never be suppressed. And Jason Hoover's life, give him credit, he got to do what he wanted to do. He got to do what he was supposed to do. He recognized that. He was able to make a living at it. God bless him. And maybe 20 years from now, they'll talk about him the way they talk about Drake or anybody else who's popular in Canada now, because he did the work and people remembered how good he was. He went all the way down.
Come up off my knees and lose my keys. So freedom.
Get